right, yeah. We'll be in touch. It is Dave O'Neill on the debrief. This is my English edition. It's very exciting. We're in a British cab, like a proper London cab, driven by Dave. Say hello, Dave.
Hiya.
Yeah, he's a proper... He's got the knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
And I've got Stuart Goldsmith in the car.
I haven't got the knowledge.
You don't have the knowledge?
No, none of it.
Did you grow up in London or...?
No, I've lived here for the last 12, 13 years, something like that. Yeah.
But you live in a regional centre now.
I now live in Bristol. This is very inconvenient for the work I do in London.
Yeah, yeah, but in Australia, a few comics live in regional sort of places because they can just commute.
By Australian standards, it's very near. It's a mere 110 miles away on an extraordinarily expensive bit of train track.
How long does a train take from Bristol to London?
Hour 40.
Okay, that's quite far, isn't it?
Yeah, enough that if you do consecutive nights gigging in London, you've kind of got to stay in London.
It's like, yes.
You know, it's too expensive, time-consuming driving in there. I'm starting to turn now, I'll just go back and forth.
Did you move to Bristol because you grew up there or your wife grew up there?
No, this is a line from a show, but the line is... 6 years, we had a long-distance relationship, me in London, her in Bristol. She got tactically pregnant, now I live in Bristol.
Right, okay.
But she won the argument.
So she's from Bristol?
No, weirdly, I'm from Bristol. This is very boring.
It's not boring at all, I find it interesting.
So I was born in Bristol, but moved away when I was 6 years old.
Sure.
She grew up in Surrey, which is like a nice bit to the south of London. And she went to university in Bristol and stayed there and loves it. So now, in the last couple of years, when I've been living there, I've had extra license to kind of slag it off. And when she's exasperated with me complaining about how inconvenient and non-London it is, I can go, hey, back off, I'm from here. I'm allowed to slag it off.
I'm a Bristol person. Because Stuart, of course, for people that don't know, does a great podcast. And one of the reasons I started podcasting was because of his podcast.
Yeah, another one.
The Comedian's Comedian. Yeah. Which, how long have you been doing this podcast for?
6 years.
Yeah, wow.
I've been saying 5 years. And then I looked at the... Because we're on our way in a cab to... I'm going to go and interview Terry Alderton for the second time. And I realised the last time I was looking at the dates yesterday. He was like episode 12 or something around then.
Yeah.
And... I checked out the dates and I was like, holy shit, it's been 6 years.
So 6 years, you would have been one of the pioneers. Because like Dum Dum in Australia, they've been going for eight.
Yeah, I remember hearing about them very early on. And when people were excited about my podcast, they'd go, oh, have you heard about these Dum Dum guys? And I'd be like, yeah, they sound like pricks. Because I was like, get off my patch, the internet.
And Marin, of course, was what?
Marin had been going for a long time.
Yeah, right. So why did you start doing the podcast then?
Let me try and say this in a way that I haven't said it 100 times. I will try and honestly say it.
You become accustomed to the story.
No, I'm not.
People always ask me.
I'm not slagging off your question.
Where do you get your ideas from? That's coming up.
Where
do you get your ideas from? Oh, they look at your Wikipedia page. You studied to be a teacher. Yeah, certainly did.
Why did I start? I was definitely aware of Marin's show. I hadn't heard loads of them. Yeah. There was a podcast in the UK called Marsha Meets, comedy.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, and it was nice. It was interesting, but it was a kind of meeting. It was like a friendly encounter rather than nuts and bolts.
Get very in-depth, I've got to say.
Started off getting really in-depth about people's writing process, and these days I now get very in-depth about their mental health.
Yeah.
I think really, I tell you what, there were several factors in confluence, and one of the biggest factors was I did a reality show in the UK, a comedian's reality show called Show Me the Funny, which sank without trace, thank God.
Was that a competition show?
Yes, it was. Right. It was billed to us as MasterChef for comedians.
Sure.
It was actually like X Factor for comedians, but it didn't really work. But we were constantly... It was a bit, you know, it was a little bit like RuPaul's Drag Race, which I love.
I don't want
to be on RuPaul's Drag Race. So we were constantly interviewed, you know, those little kind of cutaway interviews about how it was going. And we were supposed to be kind of saying, oh, you know, I'm worried about that. I think this comic is going to have a real threat this week, all of this shit. Whereas they didn't, like in these hours and hours of interviews, they didn't ask us anything real. They didn't ask us anything about the challenge we were doing, which was writing jokes. So it was sort of out of frustration about that.
Yeah.
Also just because I wanted to be a better comedian. I like making work for myself. You know, it's easy to be a... It's possible to be a comedian and use it as an opportunity to kind of hang out and have a fun life.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, I like trying to turn it into a day job and make it really painful and boring.
Yeah, but also you're probably learning stuff. I learn stuff from listening to your podcast. So it's like an in-service. Yeah. It's like, you know, when teachers have that day off, and I've gone and done stand up with these things. They have like a guy talking about maths. They have a guy talking. So it's like an in-service for comedians. Your podcast.
Yes, I didn't expect that would be true, but I can't believe that I didn't expect it, because it really is. And I've got something like, it must be 80 people now on this list of people who told me that my show in some way or other gave them a nudge to start doing stand-up. So recently I got a hefty donation from a listener who has just won a big competition. Like a new act competition.
Yeah.
But obviously lots of people start because, or partially because of the show. And I've no idea if they're any good. Every so often I'll run into it's happening more and more now, I'll run into a newer comic who does a great gig and then sidles up and goes, I was really pleased to be gigging with you because I started because of the show.
Your podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Gratifying. It's lovely to be ruining so many people's lives in this way.
That's fair enough. And the name of that person is, we'll just insert it there. All right, we won't do that. Well, you know, the first time I actually heard you was not on your podcast, but on Never Not Funny.
Oh, right.
Which
okay.
is one of my favourite.
Yeah.
That's in my top five.
Oh, it's a great show.
Podcast.
Jimmy is such a great guy. He's lovely.
Oh, so for people that don't know, it's like two guys in America. Jimmy Pardo is a comic. He's got his producer, Matt, and there's two sort of sidekicks that they abuse, Garen and... What's the other one?
I can't remember. Garen's the one I know.
Garen
I
and...
I can't remember the guy.
The other guy does the technical stuff. And it is a little bit like the little Dum Dum Club in that it's like that... It's like a breakfast zoo collegian atmosphere.
Yes.
Whereas you're more... one-on-one interview.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, but Pardo is so fast.
Oh, Pardo.
He is just one of those... He's one of those people who... He'll forgive me for saying this. He's one of those people who it's almost a relief... it's almost a relief that he exists because he's so, so funny, but isn't a massive name. And when oneself is feeling a bit like, oh, for fuck, what have you got to do?
Look at Jimmy Pardo.
You can look at Pardo and go, well, listen, Pardo isn't successful. Funny is he? He is successful, but he didn't get up where he should be.
No, because his generation of people like, not Leno, but the people sort of just above that. He's been doing it longer than me. Yeah. So he started in the 80s, Jimmy Pardo.
Yeah.
But the thing I love about him is that he's my age, he's got the same music taste. So the first one I ever listened to, he said, last night, guys, I went and saw Midgeur. Now, you would probably know who Midgeur
is.
From Ultravox.
Sure. Right,
of course,
I mean, I've heard of him.
Yeah. Vienna, the big hit. And anyway, the guys you work with didn't know who he was, of course. And so that really got me in his music knowledge. But I did hear you on that. And then I'd heard about your podcast.
Yeah.
So then I started listening, and it's been fantastic, your podcast. And you really do, as opposed to me, I don't really ask hard questions. But you, like, I'm trying to think of some of the ones... Like the great late Sean Hughes.
Yes.
When you're sort of suggesting to him that he was depressive or sad or...
Yeah.
And he's going, no, I'm not sad. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
But it's like, my dude, you are sad. Your whole persona's a sad sack,
really,
isn't it?
I really like asking people if they're happy. And Because often people are really stopped in their tracks by that. I like to try and sort of soften them up and then ask you very abruptly. One of my favourite... Do you know the Pyjama Men?
Yeah.
Seen them in the festival circuit?
Yeah, yeah. They've been going forever.
Shanoa from the Pyjama Men. I said, are you happy? And he goes, yeah. No! And it was just lovely to sort of see. I think, like with a good joke, a good bit of material. A bit of material I like is something where the comic realizes something during the bit. And I think that's in the interviews. I love it when you hear someone work something, when you hear someone say something, and then as they're saying it, they go, oh, yeah, I do think that.
Yeah, that was a fantastic interview. The Jo Brand interview was fantastic.
Oh, thank you. That was a good
one. She's great. That was a live one, wasn't it?
Yeah, I do.
Which how do you feel about live?
About 25% of them are live, and here's how I feel about them. I like the idea of being able to make money from the podcast.
So exactly.
If I could sell tickets to this would be good. But it's really hard to book them, to sell tickets to my show, because my show isn't me riffing and being funny. It's not like Dum Dum where they go, it's going to be us doing our thing, whatever.
With guests and guests, it's going to be hilarious.
Mine is all about, like, right, if I get Ricky Gervais, I can sell 500 tickets. But if I get Comedian X, then maybe I'll sell 60 with a push, you know, because and to be honest, a lot of my listeners don't listen for the live experience. They listen because it's an intimate one-on-one thing.
Yeah, it's the inside.
And often people are less insightful. They're more funny, they're more engaging in front of a crowd often, but you get fewer of those moments where people really surprise themselves.
Open up as much. Because
exactly.
You're interviewing comedians and they're playing half the audience too.
Exactly. And I really like stopping them from doing that, and it's quite fun to stop them from doing that in front of a live audience.
Yeah.
You go, no, calm down. I mean, I don't know if you heard the Stuart Francis one.
No, I haven't heard that.
But that was a brilliant comic. He's, you know, amazing one-liner guy from Canada, based in the UK. And I brought him on the show. I think it was the second podcast he'd ever done. He didn't know what to expect. And
so he was doing gear?
he couldn't stop performing. He wasn't doing gear, but he was just riffing constantly.
And you can
hear my heart break 15 minutes in. I'm actually saying to him, this is really funny and it's absolutely not what I wanted.
for sure. And you know, the other one, which is one of my favourite bits of stand-up ever, was that Canadian guy, Mark Forward? Mark Forward?
Yeah, it's Mark Forward.
I remember seeing him, I was sitting home one night and I was watching one of those Just for Laughs, which I don't watch a lot of, and he came, this was years ago, and he does a routine about homebrew.
Have you seen it? No, man.
About how you go to a party and the guy comes up and goes, you still drinking that normal shit? You haven't gotten a homebrew yet? Because when I grew up, homebrew was a bit of a thing. I don't know why in Australia, you'd go to barbecues and your uncle would go, don't drink that normal shit. Get over here and have some homebrew. And it was just, and the routine's all about this. And of course, the punchline is he's got a homebrew and he drinks it and almost vomits. But it's one of those bits of stand-up that I go back to occasionally just to watch because it's so joyous.
Yeah.
Do you have something like that you go back? Is there something? I don't watch a lot of stuff on YouTube or anything like that.
Not really.
I can't be bothered.
No, I don't watch my stuff on YouTube. And because of the research that I do for podcasts, now watching stand-up often feels like work.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favourite things to do is watch a comic who has turned down the podcast, someone who's declined, because I can completely relax all of the questions. I'm just like, oh, I'm just going to watch this guy and have a it's going to be wonderful watching comedy.
Yeah.
Having ruined it for myself. But I do, there's certainly bits of...
Who would you buy a ticket to go and see, you reckon? What comedian would you buy a ticket to go and see?
I buy tickets to comedy all the time.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Good on you.
Yeah. Well,
I went and saw Noel Fielding because my wife wanted to.
Oh, yeah. I saw Noel Fielding when he was new. I saw Noel Fielding. I saw the Comedy Zone in Edinburgh, which is like four acts doing 15 minutes.
Yeah.
When it was Lee Mack, Noel Fielding, and two people I can't remember. And Lee stormed it, and Noel died and did the entire set to me because I was like, whatever I was, 18 years old.
You were laughing.
Sat down front and centre, the only person laughing. Total silence. He delivered the entire set to me.
Yeah, the Boosh toured Australia before they got a TV show.
How did that go?
In 2000. I shared the same room with them, not a hotel room, but we had the same venue. Uh-huh. Get this for a lineup: me, Johnny Vegas, and the Mighty Boosh. Begs the question, what happened to me?
Yeah.
But anyway, they were hilarious. I mean, they remind me of the Goodies. You know, that's what. And I talked to Noel, was always off trying to romance.
Yeah,
I used, you know,
that's beautifully put.
Yeah, but Julian was, of course, as per character, quieter. And we used to sit backstage and talk about the Goodies.
Yeah.
Then Johnny Vegas would turn up covered in, you know, clay. Where he used to do that routine, which I always thought
he was doing the Potter's Room at the time.
Where he would just basically get a... You couldn't do that now, I reckon. He would get... I thought they were a plant, but they weren't a plant. He would get a woman up from the crowd and do the ghost scene with the Potter's Wheel.
Yeah.
Did you ever see it?
No, I never saw it. It's the stuff of legend.
Oh, man. And the woman would be covered in clay. He's sitting behind her. Anyway. But no, they were... The other bit of material that I watch sometimes, I watched the other day, which will probably surprise you, is Peter Kay's routine. Because I remember I came home from doing stand-up one night and my wife said, oh, there was this British comic on Parkinson who reminded me of you because he was fat and that has that working class kind of... And there's a routine about his dad playing keyboards in Mark Arman's band.
Oh, I don't know the band, I'm sorry.
Because I'm sure, because he's massive here, isn't he, Peter Kay?
Yeah, he's huge, absolutely huge.
He's huge, and so he's not...
There are huge gaps in my knowledge for the big commercial acts,
because
I don't...
Lee Evans and all those guys.
Exactly. Yeah.
All these guys, I remember when I came to London occasionally, I never saw them do stand-up, but you would hear about them, but Peter Kay does this... I mean, I know a lot of people in England probably go, oh, he's too mainstream, but this routine is hilarious about his dad playing keyboards, because he stands up and mimes to the song. Anyway.
Yeah. I like going to see... When I'm at Edinburgh, it's my 25th Edinburgh Festival this year.
Jesus Christ.
I'm celebrating it.
Commiserating
it. I go and see comics that you... I mean, they don't call themselves alt comics, but they're effectively, you know, non-mainstream comics.
Yeah, middle-aged.
No, sorry, not old. Not alt.
Alternative?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I see, like, really alternative. Like, I love... There's a guy called Matt Ewins, who I've seen, like, his last eight shows. And... last year he got some really great press, and he does that. He's so anti-comedy, but he's really funny. But every time a bit of PR comes his way and asks him for a photo for a thing, he'll just send him a picture of a different comedian.
Oh, okay,
he just doesn't give a fuck. He's so funny.
So that's sort of Simon Munnery sort of was one of the kings of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Did you ever hear the best idea in the world? I'm forever telling people about this. The box, the strobe box that Munnery used to have.
No.
So he would write the most offensive word in the English language backwards. He'd cut it out of black card backwards in front of this strobe light, and then when someone heckled, he'd take it out and shoot it at the audience, and that word would be written on everyone's retinas the right way around, and even if you close your eyes it didn't go away.
Fantastic.
Like that, what an idea.
Yeah, he's come to Australia a lot.
Yeah,
Munnery.
Yeah, he has. He's always.
Did he marry an Australian?
Yes, he did. He's got material about it. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Although I just anything like that, because I used to do street shows. That's why I know.
I've got to ask you about that.
I used to be a street performer, right? So I'm used to, like,
man, and you're saying it in open on a podcast.
whenever comics talk about how dangerous they are, or however, like, you know, these guys will do anything. Like, three of my mates nicked a bin lorry. Do you know what I mean?
Wow.
Someone parked a bin lorry at the back of the pitch. They were doing an impromptu three-hander. The guy got out, left the engine running, and walked into a pub, like, use a bathroom or something. The engine was running. They looked at each other. They climbed in, and they drove it away. So tell me again about how dangerous edgy you are.
Edgy you are in your club room, doing your little gig. So street performing, what did you... Were you a juggler? Were you a...
I was a juggler. I used to juggle... No, well...
How long did you do it for?
Oh, man, like on and off for 10 years or more, yeah.
So you started when you were like 18 or something like that?
16.
Wow.
Yeah. Not full time. There were times when I was full time.
Yeah.
That's what took me up to Edinburgh this summer. I used to have two things. When I started, I used to do a double act with my best mate, and we would do a comedy acrobatics thing where the acrobatics were terrible. And all of that stuff, it's just an excuse.
You're doing it on concrete.
Yeah. Well, he would jump over the head of the tallest person in the audience. He'd do like a running hurdle over them into a cup of water.
And he could do that.
Yeah, weirdly, he could. We built up all this stuff and he did these two little kind of fake out ones. And then everyone thought we were going to fake out the last one, but he could actually do a running hurdle over like a 6'8" man.
Sorry, can I just break you? Jamie's Italian, I thought they closed down.
They closed down in Australia.
Oh, they're still open here.
That is a news story, I believe, very recently in Australia.
Yes.
Jamie's have been kicked out of Oz.
It's a genuine Jamie Oliver. Anyway, and so how... It's not unusual for street performers to become a stand-up. Well, it is sort of unusual, but there are a few famous examples.
There's a few famous
The guy who just died recently from Night Court, he was a street performer. Night Court was a sitcom in America.
Okay.
And was in Australia. And he, because I supported David Strassman for a while.
Oh, wow.
And he was a street performer.
Was he really?
Strassman told me he was a street performer, and he learned off the Night Court guy. Who's like a famous street performer.
Okay.
Because you watch Night Court, he was a judge, he wasn't even that funny, but everyone said, oh, that guy's a legend, the guy's a judge, he was a street performer.
Yeah, right.
In Australia, we've got like Glenn Nicholas, who was a legendary comic, he was very big in the 80s and 90s, he was a street performer too. But street performers can do a little bit of everything. Do you bring any of that out on stage?
Never. I remember.
Not even at corporate gigs?
I'd be tempted. One corporate gig, and it went so well, I thought, what the hell am I doing? Why don't I do this every time?
Fuck, yeah.
But I remember when I started, like, I stopped doing street performing because I got bored of having to do the tricks. Do you know what I mean? Like, there'd be fewer and fewer skill bits in my show until I was doing 45 minutes of... Not exactly stand-up, but really improvisy kind of crowd work and stuff. Like sort of emceeing it.
Yeah.
And then tiny bits of tricks. I was like, I'm so bored of these tricks. And I just wanted to... Like, when I started, there was a guy called Paddy Bramwells, who's been going for years and years and years.
Oh, yeah.
A street performer and also a comic. Been on the circuit for a long time. And now a teacher. Teaches theatre, I think. And I remember him saying to me, I remember the cafe in Covent Garden, sat around the corner, and I was like, Paddy, I think I want to get into doing stand-up. How do I start? And he said, oh, you know, you go through Time Out and anything that's got a phone number in those days, anything that's got a phone number, just give them a ring and say it's an interested spot. And I remember people at the time, other street performers around this table where we'd all sit and have breakfast, we used to take turns so that we could legitimately stay there for hours and hours on a cold morning. So pathetic.
Fair enough.
But wonderful.
Yeah.
A couple of three people would say to me, just take a trick on in your back pocket. And I thought, no, because if I have that, I'll definitely use it. Like, I knew enough that I needed to just go on and have me.
Sure.
The rule is no props ever.
Sure. I play guitar. I was in a band in the 80s and stuff, and I played bass.
Yeah.
And when I started, I used to end my act playing bass lines of the 70s and 80s. So I do Smoke on the Water, I do Grease.
It's such a shame the listener can't see what you did with your shoulders when you said that.
I brought it back for the Dum Dum Club because they used to mock me about it.
Oh,
we did it at a live thing. And I tell you what, it went off that I brought it back. I did a country gig.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember going on at 10:30 at night and thinking, thank fuck I got my bass here because it's going to rip this all apart. But you're right, it is. I mean, eventually I stopped doing because I couldn't be bothered. That's one of the reasons I left the band, because I didn't want to carry equipment anymore.
I think you have to...
Well, you've got to step away from it.
Like, I can't even... This isn't even a thought. It's just like a guiding principle in my body. Like, it has to be hard, because if it is hard, if it stays hard... This is sounding very bad.
Oh, yeah.
But then you will have to be better, and you will have to keep growing and changing and learning.
Yeah.
And now, just like, I would love to have had a bit of circus stuff to whip out at a corporate gig. And I did on one particular occasion because they asked for it specifically.
Oh, don't feel bad for that
but
kind of thing.
But now, just recently, I've started to go, oh, I think I've worked out the knack of how to do corporate gigs. I say this, I'm doing one tomorrow.
Yeah.
This will probably make me die there. But...
But is it for a large company or a government thing?
No, it's a big company. I don't really do any government kind of stuff. Yeah, this one tomorrow is for a... It's like an awards ceremony for young people in business or something like that.
Oh, you'll be all right.
Listen.
You've got a funky haircut.
I have worked out how to be rude to them in a way that they enjoy.
Yeah.
And that I wouldn't have done that if I'd just gone out and juggled or done a tightrope walk or whatever else. And actually, I haven't worked it out, but I've got the taste of it now. I'm like, oh, hang on a minute. I could have a diary full of corporate gigs and no dread if I can work out how to do this.
Yeah.
Because I've got the dread right now. Yeah. I won't have the dread until I walk off tomorrow night. But I tell you what clued me up to it was about 6 months ago, I did one where I had had, I've got a two-year-old, and I had 2 hours sleep. It was about this disastrous night. And then I had to get the train into London, and I got there for this gig, and I opened the show by saying, it was a big awards ceremony, like very cool kind of, you know, media people.
Yeah,
and I just opened
the worst
saying,
crowds.
Like,
well,
they were bad.
Advertising people and media people.
I'm just going to say,
the worst
they
crowds.
Were bad. They were great. 10% of them were advertising people and they hated me.
Yeah.
But
are they sitting there going, I could do that?
Yeah. Yeah, well, maybe. Look at this guy. There's a guy sat on an armchair in the street in his undies. Good work.
Drinking.
Brought his own chair.
Oh, I love London.
But he, anything. I open by saying, guys, I'm going to level with you. I've had 2 hours sleep. I'm hallucinating right now. Let's just fucking try and get through this.
And they really liked it because I wasn't trying to please them. You're honest.
It's really obvious now, but I think I spent a long time trying to please a corporate gig. Then no wonder you're feeling dread.
Well, I talk to the crowd. I mean, if it's a smaller gig, it's easy. If they're all working in the same company, if they're all working in the same accounting firm, I just get there 10 minutes beforehand. I go, what does that guy do? What does that girl do? What is it? Who's just had a baby? Yeah. Okay, right. Then I walk and I go, oh, God, gee, you'd work in IT, wouldn't you, mate? They all give you around the board. It's like a magician. Look, you look fucked, mate. Have you had a baby recently?
So, yeah, that reminds me. I've got this thing which I've probably been doing for a year or two now. I should probably retire it. But at a club gig, if I'm closing, I've started walking out, particularly if I'm coming from somewhere else, and sometimes I pretend I'm coming from somewhere else, just walk out and go, great to be here. So I've got to feel my way into the room. I missed the beginning of the show, and then I point to the likely looking person and go, presumably you've been spoken to.
Yeah.
That, do you know what I mean? And
often
it's an honest guess, and it's 100% right, and it brings the house down. And you can fake it, and once or twice I've faked it.
Of
course.
No, I don't feel bad about that. I don't feel bad about that at all.
But
awards nights are kind of harder.
Give me more tips to survive corporate gigs then. That's a good, because that's funny.
The award nights are harder because they're from different companies.
Yeah,
I did one for the cloud, people that own and work in the cloud. That's the guy explained to me, you know, they're not actually clouds. Here's me thinking, well, what are they? He goes, they're like warehouses in places like Leeds or whatever, where there's one bloke walking around with a clipboard. They're all just hard drives in a warehouse. That's what the cloud is. and anyway, he goes, so I do a few jokes in the cloud, gets nothing, so I just go back to my normal stuff.
Yeah.
But I talk to them or pretend to talk to them.
Yeah.
Basically.
Pretend to talk to them.
Do fake audience interaction.
Pretend I'm their friend. Yeah, fake audience interaction.
Fake audience interaction. But the hardest ones are awards nights where there's 300 people. They're all sitting on round tables. They're all from the same industry, but they sort of don't know
each other. Everyone's uptight. Everyone wants to wants to give a good account of themselves and not be seen to be laughing.
My most recent favourite one is what I do when I do stockbrokers and assholes, basically, property developers. Like, I go and do this property council, and the guy goes, they're not going to listen to you. They're all assholes. I say, mate, watch this. And I just go, and I go, all right, who's the richest guy here? We'll do it by suburb. Where do you live, mate? And then they go, you know, say Leeds or something. I go, nah, you're out. Okay, where do you live, mate? Mayfair. You've won, buddy. Hang on. Are you renting? Yeah, I'm renting. Fuck, you're out. So that really gets their attention with those guys who are naturally pricks.
Yeah. Yeah.
But just before I came to London, I'm here on a holiday with my kids and wife. The last gig I did was for people that make sauces for Unilever. So they work in the sauce division of a massive company. And they sell to prisons, nursing homes, restaurants, you know, big clubs.
Okay, okay.
And so it was in this posh restaurant in near Sydney, and I got there to watch the awards. They gave out these awards. Oh, my God, we're here.
Oh, what? Wow.
But I watched their awards and just made notes and brought my notes up with me and just honestly paid out on them for 20 minutes. And it was great. It was really good.
Do you want to get him to drive around London a few more times?
I'm just going to drive around London.
We can find a place.
We'll go. You're listening to The Debrief with Stuart Goldsmith and Dave the Cab. Thanks, Dave.
You're welcome,
Dave. There we go.
Hi there, I'm Carl Quinn.
Hi, I'm Andrew Young. We are The Clappers, your source for all kinds of sauce when it comes to cultural entertainment in the podcasting style.
That's us, we're The Clappers.
You can listen to us wherever you get your podcasts, and you know where that is.
Anyway, we're out on The Debrief with Stuart Goldsmith. We're backstage now at his venue, which is called... You're interviewing a British comic. I've forgotten his name. Good one. Yeah, well, we've got to watch a film and then you interview him on your podcast.
Yeah, Terry Alton.
Terry Alton, who's famous.
Sorry, your delivery was so casual there. Yeah. I didn't realise we restarted.
That's my style, unfortunately. And I've got some questions I ask everyone. But normally I do a gig with someone, but we can still ask about this podcast. Mm-hmm. These are debrief questions, which I got off the internet. So what went well in my interview with you and why? You're a professional interviewer,
yeah.
Stuart.
You've got the casualness of your tone is very disarming.
Yeah.
I quite enjoyed that.
True.
It's very casual.
True.
We don't know each other very well, but
no.
I feel very disposed.
At ease.
You.
Yeah. Yes. What
didn't
go well?
That rather than say at ease, I'll say I feel disposed towards you, David.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I was trying to think of what class you are, because they say in England you can tell. So you'd be middle class.
Yeah.
You're from middle class background?
Yeah, middle class as the day is long.
They're not cheering for us, by the way. There's a spoken word venue.
It's the phrase, as middle class as the day is long. It's one of my catchphrases.
What didn't go well? What didn't go well?
Well, I worry
about... It was hot in that cab.
I can't relax because the background noise, I worry that this isn't going to...
That's fine.
And also, there's music playing in the background. If you put this on SoundCloud, the algorithm will spot this music in the background and
can charge me.
Because it's copyright.
Really? Oh, no, I've got something where... That's very light music, though.
Yeah, I know. I get nervous about stuff like that.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah,
that's good.
You bother recording a thing and then suddenly it doesn't work.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But don't worry, it'll work. It'll be fine. Were there any organisational hazards that got in the way? That's one of my other questions.
The organisational... Well, we had to have the car window, the taxi window.
Yeah, the window's up.
Your ineptitude at not taking a picture in the cab.
Yeah, I should have taken a picture.
We should go and hail a different cab now and give him a fiver to sit in the back and take a picture.
Yeah, we should. We'll do that.
We've got time. We can do that.
How can we do better next time? That's my question.
I tell you, the strongest bit for me was the off-mic tips on how to do corporates.
Corporates, yeah, sure.
So what you should do is do a...
You should write a book.
Well, you should do online learning. You should sell a video of you explaining how... Hey, do you want Dave's tips on how to do corporates?
Sure.
You want to
sell
them, mate? Sell the knowledge. Carve it up.
Okay, sell the knowledge. True. I always want to ask you this. Are you happy? Because Stuart asked everyone that question lastly on his podcast.
I really, really am.
You're happy?
I really am.
How old's your kid now?
He's 2 and 3 months.
Yeah, so walking
and... one on the way.
Oh my God, congratulations.
Yeah,
so walking and talking.
Walking and talking and hilarious. And that first...
Material.
The first 18 months, I found so much harder than I was expecting to. And Dave Anthony from the Dollop podcast.
Yeah, he's a very funny man.
He said to
me, I don't know him, but he's very funny.
And we're close personal friends. And we're close personal enemies. He doesn't like anyone.
He's a funny guy.
He's very, very funny. He said to me, he said it was 9 months. He said in about 9 months, they lock onto the dad. And I was so glad he said that because the first, I was finding it so hard and I just had that in mind. And in all honesty, it was about the, I mean, it wasn't all happened. It was great bits, but... Round about the 18-month mark, he suddenly blossomed into this person who's like my best mate, and I love it. So, yeah, that's great. I'm very happy.
You're having a second one, which is good, because you're avoiding the only child, which is a good thing. Are you an only child?
I'm not.
No, good. Okay, not that there's some very good examples of only children, but there are a few that... Anyway, whatever. But you'll find with the second one, which I've got three, that the second one... You know, with the first one, you spend your life on the ground playing with them?
Okay.
Playing trains or cars teddies or whatever. Once the second one turns up, the second one doesn't want to play with you. They want to play with the kid.
Yeah, right.
With their older brother or sister. So it's what you've done is created a buddy for your child, which is good. Because they will go away and play for an hour together.
I think it is good, but I am pretty fantastically needy. So okay. I think the fact that, like, there's a rival for my affections.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a problem.
It's all good. The other thing I was going to say, too, you know what? You're much better looking in real life than you are in your photos.
Thanks, mate. I'm not very photogenic.
Because when I saw your photo, the Comedian's Comedian podcast, and you've got that sort of... Are you wearing glasses?
No, it's the point of that picture was supposed to be it's taken as if you're on stage with me. It's not a successful image, and I'm rebranding soon.
I just assumed. Thank you. Thank you, crowd. Thank you, crowd.
Every time I mention a rebrand, they're like, yeah.
I just assumed that you would be nerdier, but you're not nerdy at all.
Oh.
Just because of the nerdy nature. When I'd listened to your podcast and I hadn't met you, and then I met you last year at the comedy festival at the pub where we had lunch with other comics and the Standard. And yeah. Interesting, because I just assumed you would be nerdier.
Are there any organisational hazards associated with that?
No, that's a good thing.